Good evening.
Hi.
This holiday eve, thank you all for coming out. Well, a couple of months ago, I spoke up here about patience, and I just happened to see a couple of nice things this week on patience, and that I'd like to share, and I think it should just slide right into a nice discussion on Zazen and wholeness and the middle way. So let's see if that's actually the case. Reb Anderson talks about patience in its sort of classical way of sitting wholeheartedly in the midst of our suffering, in the midst of our life, in the midst of suffering. And NPR did a radio story on a jazz musician, Abdullah Ibrahim, from South Africa. Nelson Mandela called Abdullah Ibrahim the Mozart of South Africa. And Abdullah Ibrahim said that patience is the foundation of spirituality. And I think that's about right. Sitting in the midst of suffering, or sitting in our lives, to be able to sit there. We might think when we first notice suffering, we are identifying this person here that's not doing too well, that's suffering from whatever that is. And then when we remember our bodhisattva practice of the six perfections, one of them being patience, we kind of drop that individual self. We just join everything as one big picture, so that we're no longer the individual who is suffering, but we just are settling into our lives fully. Not with an ego, but just interdependent with all things. Abdullah Ibrahim and his wife left South Africa in 1960 after a series of demonstrations and then some police and army retaliation against the people of color demonstration that led to injuries and deaths. And they were away for 30 years. They lived in Europe and played music with Duke Ellington and brought awareness to Europe and then America about the ongoing apartheid struggles in South Africa. And they patiently waited till they could go back and be safe. And of course, we all know Nelson Mandela patiently waited in prison for 27 years until he was released and could continue to free all beings in South Africa and open the hearts of the world around him. So this patience, this foundation of our spiritual life, of just dropping the individual self and joining the whole world, coming from wholeness, is our practice of patience. Reb Anderson says that when we practice patience in this way, we're joining the Buddhas, we're joining the Bodhisattvas, we're surrounded by Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, because that's exactly where Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are, is in the midst of suffering. He says they're not on the suburbs of suffering. They're not on the outskirts of suffering. They're in downtown suffering. But they're joining everyone. Deborah Johnson, Reverend Deborah Johnson, has said that she gave a talk once on being on non-dual political activity. And she says where you start is just your total confidence that the world is one bright pearl. That's she didn't say that because that's a Buddhist term. But there's no separation. That the world is one wholeness. You're just totally convinced that that's the case, and then from that point of view, you can start saving all beings. You can start the work that needs to be done when suffering arises. But first you have to, in whatever religious tradition you come from, really be confident that, you know, we're all one interdependent body. And yet, maybe some people forget this. And so, from this point of view, I'm going to relieve suffering people. We have an opportunity a week from Friday to participate in a gathering at the courthouse of people concerned about some of the prison camps for our immigrant family, children and their parents. And we can feel a little separate. We can feel the real suffering is happening 500 miles away, 1,000 miles away, and we're kind of worried, and we can do our best from this point of view. So that's the duality of suffering. And the interdependence of suffering is that somehow it's just pulling at our heartstrings to think that this is happening, you know, right now, that there's no hot meals for third graders for weeks at a time. There's granola bars and ramen. When we feel that tug, that's the interdependent side of the bodhisattvas and Buddhas going to where suffering is, and we have the opportunity to really physically be with our interdependent environment a week from Friday at the courthouse. 7 o'clock at night. In this way, we know that the music of Abdullah Ibrahim, even though it was in New York, was coming from a place of I'm connected with suffering people all over the world, and we know that's how we become liberated from our own suffering, and we liberate others from suffering, is just with every breath in our meditation, with every breath as we drive the car, remember that we're not separated. Our life might be a little different. We might be able to tell our lives apart, but we're not separated. And what Suzuki goes on to say is that's our true face, not one, not two, not two separate lives, not completely the same life, but no separation. Suzuki gives a great phrase, and I don't know whether it was because, you know, when he wrote it in the 60s, his English wasn't so good, but it's this great phrase of the, he says, this is the oneness of duality, this idea of not one, not two, and that's our true face, the oneness of duality. Just to read a little bit of what Reb says. When you practice patience, sitting in the midst of suffering, you give yourself a gift. You wish for yourself to be happy. You want to understand what this suffering is based on and be free of it. You begin to develop compassion. Practicing patience leads to the next step, which is the mind of renunciation. Renunciation of the delusion that you're separate. What is let go of? the delusion that you're separate, that you have to hold on to yourself. You gradually see that you're not separate, and then you let go. All Buddhas are sitting in that place of suffering with you. They don't sit on the edge of suffering, in the suburbs of suffering. They sit in the downtown of suffering. Each of us is already there. But if you want to be a Buddha, you should sit in the middle of that feeling, in the middle of that suffering. Suzuki starts off in the prologue. The reason this came up is this is Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, of course. And the Monday morning breakfast study group just started this. And most of us in that group have... This isn't even the second time we've read this book. It's sort of a book that's always been with us. I think I told this story. You know, I was in graduate school in North Carolina in the 80s, and starting to get a little cranky, starting to just say, when's this going to be over? You know, I'm not going to live in North Carolina forever. I'm not going to be a student forever. When's this going to be over? And a friend of mine, you know, I was complaining, and a friend of mine said, you know, Patrick, there's this book called Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. It's a way to keep your mind fresh. And I went right down and bought it. And as I've said, I skipped those first pesky chapters on meditation and posture and breathing. And I wanted to skip those and go right to the core of the real thing. And as we said in the Monday group, where we, you know, we started with the prologue, and then posture is the first chapter, and then breathing. There's just a whole lot in there. It's amazing. But so most of us have read the book a few times, and of course I just came away saying, gee, there's just so much there. For Zen students, Suzuki says, the most important thing is not to be dualistic. Our original mind, that he later calls Buddha nature, our original mind includes everything. It is always rich and self-sufficient within itself. You should not lose your self-sufficient mind. And Neti reminded us Monday, because I was confused about this term self-sufficient, that it just meant the line before it, this self that includes everything in it. Like being whole, like nothing is outside this consciousness. There's nothing that I've got, the whole universe that I'm connected to already. You should not lose this, your self-sufficient state of mind. This doesn't mean a closed mind, but actually an empty mind and a ready mind. If your mind is empty, it's ready for anything. And then the famous line, in this beginner's mind, this original mind, there are many possibilities. In the expert's mind, there are few. And so this is Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and of course, the San Francisco Zen Center's temple is a beginner's mind temple. Remembering with our practice that our original state already has everything in it. But we usually discriminate too much and we limit ourselves. If you are too demanding or too greedy, your mind is not rich and self-sufficient. So that's sort of the definition. If you're saying, gee, it would be nicer if I were in a cooler place than I am now. It's a little bit stuffy. If I'm wanting that something out there, I'm forgetting that, oh, this consciousness contains everything. I'm connected already. I'm not separate from anything. So if your mind is not rich and self-sufficient, and if we use this original self-sufficient mind, we will lose all the precepts. That was always a confusing line for me until we talked it out in that Monday group. Of course, the precepts, these ethical guidelines about not taking what isn't given, or not praising self at the expense of others, or separating myself from the world by becoming intoxicated. The precepts are our guides to harmonizing and staying together, remembering our interdependence. So when we're doing too much of this, you know, it's too hot, I should have eaten before I came here tonight. If we do too much of that wishing we were in another place that we think of as better, we forget that we're connected and we are living in a world of this and that, me and you, comfortable place, muggy place, hot place. So we're not really remembering the precepts that are about keeping us together. So that's really a great line, that if we forget this mind of interdependence, of wholeness, we lose the precepts, or we break the precepts. But if you keep your original mind of wholeness, the precepts will keep themselves. You almost don't have to sort of say things like, should I kill somebody? Should I steal from somebody? Should I gossip about somebody? Because you're feeling so connected that the precepts are just humming along in harmony. If you start to practice Zazen, you will begin to appreciate your original mind, this beginner's mind. It's the very secret of Zen practice. I want us to remember this connection of sitting in the midst of our suffering, dropping this ego that's separating me, and I'm the sufferer, and I'm surrounded just by suffering out there that I want to get rid of, that duality. And that patience dropping that ego and remembering our connection with everything and that we have everything we need right here, right now. And of course, that's almost a meditation instruction that Dogen gave us, and where he says in our meditation, we drop body and mind. We just sit, not with the mind of Patrick that's thinking about what to prepare for dinner when I get home, or the mind that's saying, my foot is asleep. In our sitting, we drop that body and mind and just join the boundless expanse of the universe that Suzuki said is our original body, is our true self, is our self-sufficient self. I would like to talk about this Zen posture, the Zazen posture. When you sit in cross-legged position, your left foot is on your right thigh, your right foot is on your left thigh. When you cross your legs like this, even though we have a right leg and a left leg, they have become one. The position expresses the oneness of duality. There's that great phrase. The position of Zazen, cross-legged, expresses the oneness of duality. Not two, not one. This is the most important thing. Not two, not one. Our body and mind are not two and not one. If you think your body and mind are two, that is wrong. If you think they are one, that is also wrong. Our body and mind are both two and one. We usually think that if something is not one, it is more than one. If it is not singular, it's plural. But in actual experience, our life is not only plural, but also singular. Each one of us is both dependent and independent. That's pretty true. I can think of myself as pretty independent when I make my way down to Staff of Life and pick up groceries and pay for it with my credit card and come back home and prepare it. And I can say to myself, I'm taking pretty good care of myself right here. I'm pretty independent, and yet when I've got that prana energy of nutrition coursing through me, and I'm feeling a little more expansive, I think, well, how did that food at Staff of Life come to get there? Where did the gas from my car come from? So I think this is a pretty true statement. Each one of us is both dependent and independent. He goes on to talk about meditation posture. You should not be tilted sideways, backwards, or forwards. You should be sitting straight up, as if you were supporting the sky with your head. This is not just a form, or it's not just breathing. It expresses the key point of Buddhism. It is the perfect expression of your Buddha nature. If you want true understanding of Buddhism, you should practice this way. These forms are not a means of obtaining the right state of mind. to take this posture itself is the purpose of our practice. When you take this posture, you have the right state of mind. So there is no need to try to attain some special state. Jean quoted this line a week or so ago. This meditation isn't about achieving any particular state. I've actually been right in this seat trying to describe a special state. Sometimes I think it is special because we don't always get an opportunity to do this quiet meditation in such a beautiful room where we can settle in so completely and abide with confidence in our unity and harmony with all things. And sometimes I call that a special state. But Suzuki says, nope, just getting in these chairs, getting on this cushion, and throwing our shoulders back, and sitting straight up, is the whole works. Is the perfect expression of your Buddha nature. When you have this posture, you have the right state of mind. He says that when we breathe in, we think we're taking air from out there and going in here, and when we breathe out, we think it's going out there, in there, from here, out there, that there's two places. But the inner world and the outer world are actually just one whole world. The air comes into the inner world. The air goes out to the outer world. The inner world is limitless. The outer world is limitless. This inner world and outer world is just one world. It's a limitless world. So here we are sitting in this posture. And we don't have to really even think that we need to now really sit deeply for a special state. We just have to abide in this inner world that's limitless and the outer world that's limitless. There's no edge between them. Just being in this posture, following our breath, is nothing but abiding in one world. And this thing that we might still want to call I, this person, is nothing but a, he says, nothing but a swinging door, going one way when breath goes one way, going another way when breath goes another way. Nothing but this I, this body and mind is nothing but a swinging door suspended in limitless space. And we don't have to have a special mindset, a special technique to get there. We just need to sit in our chair, sit on the cushion, and take this posture and follow our breath. remembering that our true self is just the swinging door suspended in space, connected with all things. That's how we go to the courthouse on Friday. That's how we listen to the news. From that posture of non-separation, from that oneness of duality, is how we liberate all beings from suffering. So maybe there's a few of us in the class, or maybe there were other lines that popped out for other people, or for many of the others that have read the book, maybe there's other lines about this posture is the whole works that come to mind. Any thoughts? Rachel.
One line that always popped out to me from that book was that he says, it is possible to waste our time on our black cushion. So you pointed to what seems like an inconsistency, that there is no special state, there is no special posture, but it is entirely possible to miss it. So, which one is it? Is my question.
It's not one. It's not the other. My sense is that the fact that we keep coming back again and again to this posture means that we've developed the confidence that we are interdependent and whole and not separate, and that I think Suzuki was also referencing when he says here, sometimes we discriminate too much. And sometimes we become too demanding or too greedy, and that we forget our self-sufficient whole mind. So I think he's just looking at this one unified life that sometimes remembers its wholeness, and sometimes forgets and suffers. He gets even bigger. Enlightenment is not some good feeling or some particular state of mind. The state of mind that exists when you sit in the right posture is itself enlightenment. Sometimes we forget that, and sometimes we remember our connectedness. And I think those are the two things that he talks about here. Sometimes we might waste our time on the cushion if my mind is active saying, it's too hot in here. Shouldn't we open the windows more? I forget to come back to my breath and remember the limitlessness of the inner breath and the limitlessness of the outer breath. Is that okay? Thank you. Richard.
So what you said to me, this is that same as the original of the breath. And I said that for me, this is both in my head and your this word, sit as a metaphor. Sitting to me is the way of being. And I forget what sutra it's in, where it says, lying, standing.
Sitting and walking down.
I don't remember what sutra, but that for me is the truth of it, and that for me sit whole, fully, the way we would say. And when we walk, we do the same thing. And when we lie down, we do the same thing. So for me, it really it translates to the idea of what full and healing ways do we have to meditate, to calm ourselves, to find peace, to find oneness. And I would say walking in the nature would be as good as sitting. I wouldn't discriminate between the two, but I certainly would not forget to honor the value of sitting. Now, just to finish that thought, if you sat all day and did nothing else, I think Dogen or anyone would say, that would be, or Suzuki would say, now you're wasting time on the cushion because it's life to live. So I wouldn't be comfortable with the idea that you should sit all the time, just sit, don't do anything else. So those are just the thoughts that I have that sort of fill out that circle, I think, virtual race, and that you're, I think, speaking very richly to a good portion of it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Well, let's make our way outside where it is a little cooler. May the merit of our discussion, may the merit of our sitting, may the merit of our confidence in the oneness and harmony and interdependence of all things nurture us to save all beings now and throughout eternity. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I bow to you.